From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. The Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea, kicked off Wednesday with biathlon, luge, and ski jumping. But as is sometimes the case with the Olympics, these games may be remembered for more than just who can ski the fastest or skate the most beautifully. That's because last month, North and South Korea, two countries still technically at war, announced that they would march under a unified flag at the opening ceremonies. A total of 22 North Korean athletes will compete on joint Korean Olympic teams in women's ice hockey, as well as skiing and speed skating. Now, this move came as something of a shock, given that the North and South Korean governments had had virtually no direct communication for 2 years, as well as the fact that the U.S. and North Korea had been seemingly moving closer to a military confrontation in recent months. So while the sight of North and South Korean women playing hockey together may be merely symbolic, symbols matter. On this edition of Global Journalist, a look at the history of sports diplomacy and how playing games together can actually shape international conflict like that in Korea. Now, in a few moments, we're going to hear from three different experts who have been following this issue closely. But first, we're going to talk to Konstantinos Filis of the International Olympic Truce Center. That's an organization affiliated with the International Olympic Committee. He joins us from Athens, Greece, the birthplace of the Olympics. Konstantinos, welcome.
Hello.
Well, your organization is under the umbrella of the International Olympic Committee, but this idea of having a truce around the Olympics dates back to ancient times. Give us just a little bit of background.
That is absolutely correct. Back in 776 BC, according to the myth, Iphitos, the king of one of Greece's city-states, which were in constant conflict, went to the Delphic Oracle to ask how he could end these conflicts. The Oracle urged him to revive the Olympic Games as a means of temporary peace. And actually, as a result, armed conflicts gradually took a back seat as citizens who were also soldiers took part in the Games, where a victory took on great value, which resulted in a reduction in the amount of time willingly devoted to bearing arms. So every 4 years, a ceasefire was agreed to for athletes, spectators, and artists to travel to and from the Games in Olympia. And this truce was observed, though not always in full, for some 1,200 years, making it the most durable peace accord in history. And it was only back in 1993 when in modern times the Olympic family and the United Nations took the lead. And it was back then when the UN General Assembly approved a resolution entitled Building a Peaceful and Better World Through Sport and the Olympic Ideal, which actually calls upon member states before every edition of the Games to observe the Olympic truce and to use sport as a tool to promote peace, dialogue, and reconciliation.
Well, Konstantinos, if I could just put this in a little bit of context then. So you mentioned that this was an ancient tradition associated with the ancient Olympics, and then it was revived again in the early 1990s. I think the Winter Games were in Lillehammer in 1994. So in advance of that, many of our listeners will remember that the war in Yugoslavia was going on. So in advance of those games, there was an effort to have a truce, particularly since the city of Sarajevo, which was heavily damaged during that war, had hosted the games themselves. So tell us what happened.
In Lillehammer 1994, the Olympic family and the United Nations took again the lead. They proved that in coordination with each other, they can actively contribute to securing, even for a short time, the cessation of hostilities. So during the opening ceremony of the Lillehammer Winter Games, and for 24 hours, a ceasefire was achieved in the whole of ex-Yugoslavia, which was back then in war. So even in a small corner in the earth, this was a precious beginning for the Olympic family and for Olympic truce.
Well, last year, there had been a lot of concern ahead of these games that North Korea might try to disrupt them. Pyeongchang is only about 80 kilometers, about 50 miles from the North Korean border. So how did the Olympic movement play a role in trying to ensure that wouldn't happen?
We often underestimate the power of sport to bridge differences. if not to resolve them altogether. In the case of an issue as complex and difficult as that of the Korean Peninsula, which involves regional and international interests, competition between big powers, the risk of nuclear war, the upcoming Winter Olympic Games provided an opportunity for the two Koreas to come to the table for talks after an uneasy hiatus of about 2 years, as we mentioned in the beginning. And they certainly are not going to settle all their differences, but they will enable the two sides to come closer together, de-escalate tensions, at least for a short time, and bear witness to the beneficial consequences of peace, as opposed to the risks of involved in sustaining any potential for conflict. So the opportunity of the Olympic Games may serve as a springboard for talks on thornier issues, provided the two sides show the requisite political will. But regardless of the result, we should reflect on the fact that if it weren't for the milestone of the Pyeongchang Winter Olympic Games this February, there would not have been an occasion for the dialogue between Seoul and Pyongyang.
So in other words, then, because the two sides are able to talk about something small, like a sporting event, in other words, you're saying that that may foster some potential benefits down the road on more serious issues.
Exactly. And this is the vast importance of a ceasefire in war zones, or of an attempt to bring sides closer. Because if only for 16 days, that is the duration of the Olympic Games, we are provided with an opportunity to come to realize that it is better to be in a peaceful and live in a peaceful environment rather than choose the road of hostilities and of conflict. I think that this is the spirit, but also the real essence of Olympic truce. Olympic truce is a step towards peace. Olympic truce does not bring peace, but it creates the necessary conditions for the sides that are involved in conflict or that are concerned about each other's intentions to come to the table realize the benefits of improving their ties rather than the dire consequences of risking being at war.
Well, Konstantinos Filis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
A reminder that you're tuned in to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. As millions of people are set to watch athletes from North and South Korea competing together under the same flag at the Winter Games in Pyeongchang, we're discussing the role of international sporting events in diplomacy. Now, to broaden our discussion, we're going to bring in three other people who have been following events on the Korean Peninsula. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Scott Snyder. He's a senior fellow for Korean Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book, South Korea at the Crossroads, was published last month. And in Brighton, England, is Udo Merkel. He's a senior lecturer in events management at the University of Brighton, where he does research on the political and societal impact of major international sporting events. Welcome to all of you. Let me start with you, Scott Snyder. Talk to us just a little bit about this rapprochement, this engagement between South Korea and North Korea. What are the potential benefits to the two sides playing hockey together, marching together under the same flag?
Sure, Jason. Well, initially what we've seen is a kind of limited time only break in inter-Korean tensions. And now, of course, we have hundreds of North Koreans in various capacities in South Korea for the Olympic Games. The real payoff, I think, in terms of the potential impact of Olympic diplomacy on the inter-Korean conflict is likely to occur in the context of a high-level delegation visit from Pyongyang for the opening ceremonies over the course of the next 48 hours. Delegation is led by the nominal head of state, Kim Jong-nam, and it includes Kim Jong-un's sister, Kim Yo-jong. And so this would represent the highest level official contact between the two Koreas that we've seen. We've never seen, actually, a member of the Kim family from North Korea coming to South Korea. So that aspect of it will certainly be unprecedented. Well, and I think the critical question is whether or not the South Koreans can create a bridge for dialogue, especially with the United States.
Well, Udo Merkel, we heard Scott Snyder talking about this visit as being a potential bridge for dialogue here. There has been something of a history of attempts at cooperation between North Korea and South Korea around international sporting events. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this history goes back about 10 years, and it was the period between 1998 and 2008 when the South had a very distinctive foreign policy towards the North, which was based on engagement and rapprochement. And during that period of time, there were actually a number of serious talks, negotiations with the North. And one of the outcomes was several programs that involved cultural exchanges and also sport exchanges. The public in South Korea was very interested. These were the inter-Korean sports unification matches, as well as appearances at a number of Olympic Games, Asian Games, and other regional events where North and South Korea marched together, used the unification flag. But it's difficult to compare these activities 10 years ago with what's happening right now, because you've mentioned before, North and South Korea haven't really been in touch with each other for the last 10 years, have literally not talked to each other for the last 2 years. And now joining their forces, marching together at the Olympics, is not an expression or a demonstration of success based on these kind of negotiations and talks. This is much more different because it could initiate a new phase of talks, negotiations, engagement, and rapprochement. So it's very different.
So in other words, what happened previously was that there was sort of a serious political dialogue that led to sort of the symbolic meeting of the teams around a sporting event. Here we have no sort of serious political dialogue, but we're starting with the meeting of the teams around a sporting event in hopes that it will lead to political dialogue then.
Absolutely right. 10 years ago, sport was just part of a much bigger parcel of foreign policy, of a very distinctive strategy. Right now, there is a big vacuum here, and sport is used to perhaps initiate a new round of talks. And the presence of Kim Jong-un's sister is quite remarkable and quite momentous, because there are very likely to be high-level political talks. My understanding is that there is a lunch meeting on Saturday between the South Korean President Moon Jae-in and the North Korean delegation. And I would think that this will be a meeting to determine an agenda for more meetings and more talks over the last 2 weeks and perhaps beyond that short period of time.
Scott Snyder, let me turn this to you. Talk to us about where this initiative leaves the United States. The U.S. has been pushing for, Vice President Pence called them toughest ever sanctions on North Korea. Now we see South Korea saying, hey, North Korea, let's play hockey together.
Yeah, there's a risk that the U.S. and South Korea can be perceived as on different pages here, because the United States, the Trump administration, is really just in the middle of launching an international maximum pressure campaign against North Korea that is designed to drive North Korea back to negotiations. And the Olympics at present look like they could be an extension of a kind of propaganda war between the U.S. And North Korea. Certainly North Korea possibly trying to use the Olympics to normalize its image as a nuclear state, while Vice President Pence has brought with him the father of Otto Warmbier, who tragically died following an extended detention in North Korea. And Vice President Pence is focusing on North Korea's egregious human rights record.
Well, Udo Merkel, give us your sense about where the U.S. is left in all this. Do you see things the same way as Scott?
Yeah, partly I do. But I think the political agenda attached to participating in the Winter Olympics this year, or North Korea's political agenda attached to it, is a little bit more complex, because of course this is a charm offensive. Of course this is a public relations opportunity. But I think what the North Korean regime is also keen to find out, whether Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, was actually serious when he initially suggested to send a unified team to the Winter Olympics. That suggestion was made last year in June, and obviously it took Kim Jong-un about 6 months to respond to it. But now, having responded to it, he can actually see that Moon Jae-in is serious, that he wants to go a different way, that his understanding of sorting out inter-Korean relations is different from his two predecessors, and obviously very different from the much more confrontational approach of the Trump administration.
And Udo Merkel, before we lost Gail, she was talking about the Seoul Olympics in 1988 and how sports had been, there was an effort at that time for the two Koreas to work together to host those games. It didn't work out. Tell us about that episode. Is it at all instructive for what's happening today?
No, I don't think we can actually compare the 1988 Olympics with the 2018, because the 1970s and 1980s were very much characterized by this struggle of both Koreas to be accepted as the legitimate representative of the Korean people. That kind of battle was very much finished in the late 1980s with South Korea hosting the Olympics. We've moved on from that time, and the situation has obviously become much more tense these days due to the availability of nuclear weapons by the North.
Well, at that time, correct me if I'm wrong, Udo, I believe the North Koreans shot down a South Korean airliner that killed something like 300 people sort of in the run-up to those games. But Scott Snyder, let me turn this back to you. There was an interesting article recently in the New York Times highlighting the fact that young people in South Korea, especially people in their 20s, sort of don't support this joint Olympic effort. They're not that interested in unification with the North. What's going on there? Why do South Koreans, at least younger ones, seem to be losing interest in reunifying?
The South Korean public reaction to North Korea's participation in the games has been very interesting, because on the one hand, South Koreans are welcoming North Korea's participation, but the fielding of the unified hockey team has struck a chord, especially among young people in South Korea, as something that is really undesirable, because it took away opportunity for some female members of the women's South Korean ice hockey team that had been working so hard. And also, in a way, the fielding of the hockey team is a good test of whether younger generations in South Korea conceive of nationalism as associated with the nation, with South Korea, or as associated with the common race, that would be a unified concept that would bridge the two Koreas. And increasingly, younger generations are skeptical about the prospects for unification, and actually quite concerned about the cost that they in particular would bear as part of any kind of unification process that would bring together South and North Korea economically.
A reminder that you're tuned in to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. As events at the Winter Games kick off in Pyeongchang, with athletes from North and South Korea competing together under the same flag, we're talking about sports diplomacy. We're joined by Scott Snyder of the Council on Foreign Relations and Udo Merkel of the University of Brighton. If you're interested in more Global Journalist, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues, including a series of recent interviews with international journalists forced to flee their home countries. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, or check out our videocast on YouTube. And Udo Merkel, if I could go to you, now, we heard earlier in the show Konstantinos Filis talking about international sporting events as being a forum having the potential to create peace and peace talks in different areas of conflict. Historically, I think there are also a number of incidents where the Olympics or other international sporting events have been used to sort of increase tensions in some way. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I fully agree with Konstantinos that sport, of course, has the potential to build bridges, to bring people together. But that is a double-edged sword, which means the other side is that sport is also very divisive by the pure nature that it is competitive, which leads to winners and losers. That is divisive. Sport is quite often accompanied by racism, which is very divisive. There's a lot of sexism in the world of sport. So sport can also be very divisive, and that was clear during the Cold War period, so the late 1940s to the late 1980s, when sport was utterly unable to build any bridges between the two powerful alliances led by America and the Soviet Union. It even led to a huge boycott of the Moscow Olympics in 1980, followed by a boycott of the Eastern European countries led by the Soviet Union in 1984. We have individual events like the football war in Central America in 1969, where at the end of a football match, although there were lots of other factors, Honduras and El Salvador started a war against each other. So sport has the potential to bring people together, and yet quite often the evidence is and the reality is that it can also be very, very divisive.
Scott Snyder, if I could go back to you, do you get the sense that North Korea is being rewarded in some way, given the fact that its nuclear program has advanced very rapidly over the past year or two? I mean, it was just a few months ago that there was a long-range intercontinental ballistic missile that was launched out into the Pacific.
I think the verdict is out, really, on what the impact longer term of North Korea's participation in the Games is going to be. You know, there's a great risk at this point that what we're going to see is just a temporary pause, and then in April, a resumption of tensions and a resumption of both USROK military exercises and North Korean missile tests that could ramp up tensions again between the U.S. and North Korea. And so, in a way, that would be a missed opportunity. Unfortunately, this particular pause so far has not been accompanied by any kind of change in position or trajectory on the part of either North Korea or the United States over this issue of denuclearization.
Well, Udo Merkel, you follow sort of the International Olympic movement quite closely. It is, the International Olympic Committee has been under a lot of scrutiny, received a lot of criticism in recent months, particularly for the way that it's handled the sort of state-sponsored doping allegations against Russia. The IOC is under investigation in the United States by the Justice Department over, I think, racketeering and bribery allegations surrounding the awarding of games. Talk to us just a bit about what's at stake for the Olympic movement in these games.
Well, the International Olympic Committee obviously has a number of minor and major problems on their hands right now. You've mentioned one of them, which is the state-sponsored performance-enhancing drugs use of Russian athletes. But there's a second bigger issue, because the interest in hosting mega sports events such as the Olympic Games has decreased considerably over the last few years, because more and more countries and people have actually realized that quite often they don't deliver the benefits politicians and other people who are responsible actually promise them. So when the news came out that North Korea would actually participate in the Pyeongchang Olympics, that was great news for the IOC too, insofar as the kind of reputation of the International Olympic Committee, as well as the Olympic Games, was clearly improving. Here we have evidence that events can actually produce legacies, lasting legacies, can make a difference to the rest of the world. So I'm pretty sure that the IOC was delighted about the news which Kim Jong-un communicated to the rest of the world in his New Year's speech.
Because, and correct me if I'm wrong here, when South Korea made their application for the Games, one of the potential benefits that they talked about in their application was that the Games could be used as sort of a way to kickstart diplomacy and peace on the Korean Peninsula. But Scott Snyder, talk to us just a little bit about where you see this issue going over the next 2 years, over the next 3 years. Is there some room for optimism that this informal meeting that led to the joint teams playing together is going to sort of foster a new track, a new dawn in this conflict?
Well, there's room for a lot of hope. I'm not sure that there is a great chance of success, but it's definitely worth trying. And so I think that the discussions that President Moon is going to have with the North Korea high-level delegation on Saturday are absolutely critical as a means by which to understand North Korean intentions and to try to broaden North Korea's own perspective about where they're going to try to connect North Korea with the rest of the world in some meaningful way. And the fact that there is a flurry of diplomacy around the opening and closing ceremonies, just in terms of the presence of different leaders, provides additional opportunities to try to cement that set of channels that really were non-existent up until last month, when the North Korean leader indicated a willingness to join and participate and to maintain a peaceful environment surrounding the games themselves.
And Scott, if I could stay with you, our time does grow short, but that North Korean delegation you mentioned, one of the people heading it is Kim Yo-jong, the sister of Kim Jong-un. She's herself kind of a mysterious figure. What do we know about her?
Well, she's been involved in really helping to promote Kim Jong-un's image, and she's been doing a lot of behind-the-scenes work in order to help with critical events inside North Korea that promote his leadership. Her critical attribute as part of this delegation is simply that she's directly related to Kim Jong-un, and therefore she will be able, I think, to provide a frank and accurate assessment to her brother of what she learns as a result of her participation in the opening ceremonies and other events.
That's going to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Our assistant producers this week are Lily Cusack and Hunter Bassler, with supervising producer Raina Sims. Jiwon Choi is our visual editor. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. We'll leave you with a clip of the Korean folk song Arirang. Now, this is the song the North and South Korean athletes are marching to together during the opening ceremonies of the Winter Games.